From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. Forget about the consequences of failure. Failure is only a temporary change in direction to set you straight for your next success. Setting out to inspire success in all endeavors, this is the voice of a sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. It should come as no surprise that some of the founding fathers of the United States were great scientists, thinkers, and intellectuals. Benjamin Franklin comes immediately to mind in particular, with his inventions and experiments, including bifocal eyeglasses, central heating systems, and of course his famous experiment in flying a kite during a thunderstorm, thus confirming that lightning was indeed electricity. I suppose that too gave rise to the common misconception that Benjamin Franklin discovered electricity as such, but of course the phenomenon of electricity had already been known to man for some time. Nevertheless, Franklin's dangerous experiment stands testament to the bravery and foresightedness of the founding fathers. The early United States came about from a sense of life that a rational mind can appreciate. A physicist is not satisfied with half-answered questions. Rather, he seeks fully to understand the phenomenon which he studies. Likewise, the thinkers that created the United States were serious scholars of history and philosophy, and, in the task of creating a new country, sought fully to understand their subject. That subject, essentially, was man himself, and furthermore, to understand the nature of man and his relationship with others, that is, man in society. It took an arduous effort and a great amount of time to devise the institutions of early America. Notice the precision of some of the earliest documents that form the framework of the fledgling republic, including such well-known documents as the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence. The rights to life, liberty, and to the pursuit of happiness. Indeed, too many people today do not seem to discern between having the right to pursue happiness on one hand and an entitlement to happiness as such on the other. Such confusion afflicts great portions of the population both within and outside the borders of the USA. The United States of America was the world's first sincere attempt at achieving a scientific society, if you will. If in no other way, then by its founding fathers noticing the correlations between cause and effect of which history offered ample example. Where the founding fathers fell short was in their failure to define their terms and clearly to prove their dearly held postulates for the sake of posterity, a posterity that would eventually not find the rights of man to be quite as self-evident as Thomas Jefferson found them to be. 2 centuries later, those self-evident truths would become completely unknown and often attacked. Even the most civilized countries in the world would have forgotten the meaning of the words that for a short period of time enlightened the world, and that the United States itself would be on its way of becoming a laughed-at, downtrodden, mediocre nation-state, like any other stale and moribund European social democracy, and no longer the philosophy state that it once was. At this point, well into the 21st century, the world looks down on the United States, politically and morally. Of course, the world, in its arrogant, cynical, and snide tone, is largely wrong in its evaluations. What allows so many people outside of the United States, in particular European intellectuals, to get away with their bigotry and haughtiness is the fact that those who have inherited the great republic of the founding fathers have not known how or have not cared to stand up for their system on moral grounds. While criticism, on the whole, of what has been known as the American way of life are unfounded, the Americans themselves are to blame for allowing the widespread misconceptions about freedom, capitalism, and the rule of justice to go unchecked. While generalizing may be unfair to those people who are the exception, it does provide a valid frame of reference to study. In a broad view, one can only say that the American people of today, in general, do not resemble the American people of the Revolution or the Founding Fathers of the United States. Or do they? I'm certainly open to the idea that there is a silent majority that still believes in freedom and still has a good understanding of it. However, silent majorities functionally do not exist. Closet support for anything, for any position at all, is as useless as not lending any support at all. I've received plenty of closet support in my time. Being shot down and verbally heckled at the university when delivering presentations in front of classes, it seemed like literally everyone was against me at times. However, invariably, there would always be a few people who came out of the woodwork and told me privately that they agreed with what I said, but were too afraid to stand out from the crowd, and thus could not bring themselves to voice any support for my position. And the themes were not always political. I remember one classroom rumbling with laughter when I claimed it was possible to hear a radio broadcast from North America on shortwave without needing to use satellite. It's amazing to find just how ignorant the masses are about shortwave. Of course, if these young brats had at all been familiar with shortwave radio, they would likely not harbor half of the stupid ideas they do in general. But I digress. Still, those who came to me afterwards to tell me that they really agreed with me, and even tried to flatter me by congratulating me for being so brave as to stand up for what I believed, would suddenly be surprised when I responded to their kind words by biting their heads off. Just what does it help to tell someone after he's been attacked that you really agree with him, but you don't want anyone else to know? What am I supposed to do with that kind of support? Where were you when I needed you? Well, never mind me. What good does it do you to hide your own deepest held convictions? Is fear of ridicule or just of encountering an opposite opinion so debilitating that you will spend your life surrendering your values and essentially live a lie, as not to be seen as disagreeing with others? Others who are most often strangers who mean nothing to you and who would not lift a finger to help you. There was once a young lady who studied classical history with me at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. We got talking at one point about what we wanted to get out of our studies and what we wanted to do in the future. After being a bit evasive, she told me that she only wanted to study a few courses in history because she thought it was interesting, but she was also enrolled in the business school and would likely become an accountant, although she had no real interest in that. She said what she really wanted in life was to get married and raise children, and that she thought such would be most fulfilling to her. But she dare not say that out loud, since that's such an old-fashioned value, and what would people think? Really, what would people think? You see what the miserable feminists have done. I don't get upset about feminists demonizing men nearly half as much as I get upset about how miserable feminists are making life for women. Still, in the case of this young woman from the university, I blame her for not standing up for herself and being herself. I blame her for voluntarily sentencing herself to a life she does not want to live in order to placate some loudmouth feminists and to avoid being called names. Does she think the feminists are going to congratulate her or otherwise be kind to her for deciding to be a modern woman? When she turns 50 years old, will she look back on her life as a career woman and be proud and relieved that she was not accused of being quaint? Or will she regret that she gave up her real desire and goals in life? What good will closet support for traditional womanhood do for her? If fear of name-calling is greater than your passion for your values, then your values mean nothing, absolutely nothing. You lose everything important to you and gain nothing. Not even gratitude. This even applies to religious people. In particular, I'm thinking of the religious left in Europe, be it the Anglican Church or the Church of Sweden, and how they're warming up to the notions of so-called gay marriage. Even much of the religious right, such as evangelicals in the United States, are often very lukewarm in their opposition and tend to avoid the issue, with notable exceptions, of course, of the few brave types who express their real opinions on the matter. There is no escaping the fact that the very clear black-on-white written doctrine of the Christian faith is very much against homosexuality as a behavior, and that there is no latitude at all for two people of the same sex to be married to each other. It is contrary to the Christian faith. You can believe in gay marriage, or you can believe in Christian doctrine. Not both. It'd be like being a communist capitalist, or dogmatic agnostic, or progressive conservative. They are conflicting bodies of thought. The reason why so many nominally Christian bodies do not make a greater point about this is quite simply that they do not want to be labeled as intolerant by the mainstream press or by society in general. The Church of Sweden has even attempted to twist doctrine in yet another incident of Orwellian doublethink. In 2003, incitement of any kind against homosexuals became illegal in Sweden. As a result, there was serious discussion that, as a consequence, no new printings of the Bible would be allowed, due to the passages that condemn homosexuality. The topic made news for more than a week and was discussed on panel discussions carried on both radio and TV. The matter was quickly dropped when it was pointed out that the Quran would have to be forbidden as well on the same grounds. Of course, the Swedish government is, quite rationally, afraid of the possible reaction of the Muslims in the country, so the matter was dropped. Yet only 5 years later, in 2008, the former head of the Church of Sweden, K.G. Hammer, wrote a scholarly piece that determined that there was nothing in the Bible against homosexuality. The vulgar masses, who apparently have an attention span of a toaster oven, seem to have forgotten the 2003 controversy that quite nearly resulted in the Bible becoming banned literature in Sweden. How interesting, too. In spite of thousands of years of being in plain black and white, and in spite of centuries of Christian scholarship, one Swedish priest just happened to discover at the exact moment that gay marriage became a mainstream social issue that there was nothing in the Bible against homosexuality. This brings me back again to an older episode. Without knowing any more details of this story, does all that really have a ring of truth? It is clear that mainstream Christianity is buckling under to the gay agenda in order not to be called names by the mainstream media and academia. So then the obvious question arises, of what worth is the Christian faith to such people? It's my contention that if Christians fear The Guardian or The New York Times more than they fear God, then their devotions are worth absolutely nothing. If Christians believe that blessed are ye when men shall revile you, then they should welcome the derision of the mere mortals who do not share their faith, no matter what issue stands in the center of disagreement. What reverence do such nominal Christians really have for St. Stephen or St. Paul or other Christian martyrs in history, if mere name-calling is enough to silence them with regard to the most deeply held beliefs? Now that's just one aspect, that's the religious aspect. However, it's not even necessary to take it to that level as an issue. But if religiosity as such is supposed to be characterized by the faithful holding to certain eternal truths in the face of worldly opposition, then I would question the very sincerity of such self-professed Christians whose faith fails them in the face of derision. In addressing the issue of so-called gay marriage, I find that I do not even need to resort to deep interpretations of scriptures or deep moral questions, even in the secular realm, to dismiss the concept as irrational. I don't even have to approve or disapprove of homosexuality as such. It is quite simply a matter of definition. If two people of the same sex want to live together, they can do that. Each of them has that individual right, but it's not a marriage. Call it anything else you want, but not marriage. The idea of governments changing the definition of marriage is a fallacy as well, since marriage existed before the state. The word marriage refers to a very particular kind of contract between two people of the opposite sex. Now, others will disagree, but then I'd be interested in hearing a refutation of the position I hold, not a denouncement of me personally for holding it. It's not about me. It's about what words mean. It's about definitions.
Do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do-
Euclidean geometry is a good example of beginning with definitions. A point is defined as a given spot without length or width. A line as an infinite one-dimensional array of points without width. A square is the figure formed by four line segments of equal length intersecting at 90 degrees. With terms clearly defined, anyone can discuss a square without risking being misunderstood. This is important because in order to talk about something, all parties must be talking about the same thing and know what context is being used. Definition does not usually pose a problem in mathematics or in the physical sciences, where terms are largely concrete. Rather, confusion comes about in the humanities, which deal largely with abstractions. It is therefore necessary to be clear in discussion in order to discover exactly what it is that's being discussed. In a social context, what's meant by the word equality? A socialist may see the word as meaning metaphysical sameness, whereas an individualist will see it as meaning without favor in the eyes of the law. If two people, each with a different view on the meaning of the word, were to discuss equality without first defining the term, could any meaningful dialogue take place? Imagine two people arguing about a, quote, square, one believing that a square has three sides and the other believing it has four, and then being eternally embroiled in a debate over the number of degrees of angle this so-called square contains. Not until both realize what the other means can any progress be made. Again, in order to talk about something, one must be talking about the same thing. Now, it's certainly not my intention to redefine the words in the English language, but rather to emphasize the definitions I use in order to ensure that there's not any misunderstanding. Some of the most confused concepts in the humanities, especially in political philosophy, are equality, freedom, justice, and rights. Clarity requires that any abstract or ambiguous term be defined. In the context of any discussion held on VSI, freedom means political freedom, that's to say the absence of physical force from human relationships. Freedom is a freedom to an action without fear of interference from others, provided that such action does not obviate the freedom of other people. That provision is not a limitation on freedom, by the way, but rather a manifestation of freedom in a complete state of being. Yes, there is such a thing as absolute freedom, but that does not mean you're literally free to do anything to anyone. That's not a contradiction in terms. Rather, the limitation against obviating the freedom of others is an intrinsic quality of freedom. The absoluteness of freedom encompasses all other individuals who are equally free of any coercion on your part. Far from being a contradiction, it is consistency that demands that freedom not include the freedom to take away other people's freedom. Namely, if you want your freedom to be respected, you need to respect the freedom of others. By its very nature, freedom is self-limiting. A state of liberty is one in which freedom is recognized and respected. There is nothing in the universe to take away one's freedom, except for other people. Therefore, freedom means freedom from other people. For a man to be free, he must be at liberty to make his own choices, independently of the wishes or needs of others, no matter what their numbers. He must be free to disagree with others and to make his own choices. Again, this does not mean that he can choose to take actions that hurt or limit the free choice of other people. Just as any given individual has freedom, so do all other individuals in exactly the same manner as he does. Again, this invokes a fundamental scientific principle, the principle of consistency. Just as in physics, a contradiction cannot exist, neither can it in any other context. For freedom to exist for one person, so shall it be for another. Notice nonetheless that the term freedom is often confused. One certainly has the freedom, for instance, to ride a bicycle. But this does not mean that one's freedom becomes an obligation on another. It's of course conceivable that one obtains his own bicycle and disposes of it by his own will without involving another party. Therefore, the notion that one man's choice is another man's obligation cannot be accepted without further examination. Note that many people's choices today are supported by the involuntary servitude of others. The choice to obtain an education, medical attention, or gainful employment is imposed on others who do not necessarily choose to support such choices. Yet this gets little, if any, consideration. Instead, the notion that in a general sense the able have some kind of duty to help the unable, or even just unwilling, is widely accepted without logical reasoning or rational proof that this is necessarily so. Political freedom in this context means freedom from the initiation of physical force. It does not mean freedom from the laws of nature to which we are all subject. It does not mean freedom from the consequences of one's actions. It means only freedom to do what one chooses, provided it does not violate the rights of others. Justice is a term which causes some confusion. The word generally evokes a sense of goodness, right, or morality, yet a firm sense of the word is what's needed here. Justice is a firm dedication to the truth. It's the refusal to grant anything that is not earned. It's refusal to sacrifice the guilty, the good to the evil, the truth to the falsehood. Justice is a dedication to objectivity and to the scientific method of forming conclusions. There can be no higher virtue than justice, and to administer justice is the greatest responsibility anyone will have. It does not require that one know everything or that he never make a mistake. What is required is that one never knowingly sacrifice the truth for falsehood. Consider, for instance, the workings of criminal trials in common law countries. The accused party must be proved to be guilty of his crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Until such a time, he is presumed to be innocent. But why is this so? Why must not someone accused of a crime prove his innocence beyond a reasonable doubt? Why has every civilized code of justice decided upon the presumption of innocence? Well, if you consider the scientific method, you can see a connection. Firstly, one makes a claim and then forms a hypothesis, and then sets out to gather and observe evidence. And then once sufficient evidence is collected, one can make a valid claim based on what is known. The onus is to prove.
I'm a traveler. that's insanity. He's the man that led me to that place, yellow desert screen. My Shangri-La beneath the summer moon, I will return again. As the dust that blows high in June, when I'm moving through
listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. Lack of evidence to the contrary does not make for evidence of one's own position. With a certain degree of periodicity, it becomes quite fashionable to believe in extraterrestrial visitations and abductions. The arguments put forth in support of such claims are highly erroneous from the point of view of the scientific method. Firstly, those who claim to have seen UFOs fail to consider all the possibilities. Without a doubt, those who see flying objects are quite often unable to identify them. However, does this mean that anything one cannot identify is extraterrestrial in origin? Surely there are exotic dishes eaten in the Orient which be unfamiliar to the average Westerner. Would a Westerner then conclude that this unidentified food came from space? If a tribesman from a far-off jungle were suddenly transported to New York, he may not even recognize the skyscrapers or motor cars. Still, there is no question that they were built by human beings. The alien conspiracy theory had quite a presentation on shortwave radio in the mid and late 90s, as I remember. Some commentators claimed that the government of the United States borrowed alien technology to build, for instance, stealth jet planes. The argument being, I kid you not, being as shallow as, do you really think a human being could design such a plane? There's a rather crude insolence to that kind of reasoning. Just because one cannot conceive of doing or making something oneself, that does not mean that nobody could do it. We could only infer from such a statement that the speaker thinks he knows all there is to know and that nobody could have thought of anything that he himself could not imagine. For any theory to be valid, it has to be falsifiable. That means an experiment designed to test a theory must have a certain result that would mean the theory is valid, and a different result if the theory is invalid. For instance, one may theorize that two objects of different weights will fall to the Earth at the same rate of acceleration. This is a falsifiable theory and worthy of consideration, since one could set up an experiment to test it. If one drops two objects of different weights, and they do indeed fall at the same rate, then the theory is valid. If the heavier object falls faster than the lighter, then the theory is invalid, simple enough. However, if one were to theorize that all things happen according to destiny, there would be no possible experiment that could test the truth or falsehood of the theory. The result of any experiment could always be explained as destiny. Had I chosen not to broadcast VSI, one could argue that it was my destiny not to go on the radio. The fact that I've been on WBCQ could similarly be argued to have been destiny. While this would seem obvious to most, some proponents of alien visitations seem to forget this very basic rule of evidence. When asked for evidence of such visitation, they argue, "You don't think that they'd be stupid enough to leave anything behind, do you?" This means that a world visited by extraterrestrials would look exactly the same as a world not visited by extraterrestrials. That premise is not falsifiable. It cannot hold up in an objective debate. Now, I do not at all mean to suggest that I know for certain there are no such thing as extraterrestrial intelligence, nor even that the Earth has absolutely never been visited by such beings. I don't know. It's possible. However, if such claims are ever to be lent credence, they will need to be proved with evidence that can be tested by the scientific method. Lack of conflicting evidence does not make one's case. And that brings us back to the courts of law. Since lack of conflicting evidence cannot prove an argument, the accused party does not have to prove his innocence. The onus is on the accuser to make the evidence available, and then, through logical observation and objective reasoning, prove his theory to be valid. We can see from this, then, that the presumption of innocence is the basis of criminal law in civilized societies, not because it seems fair or because it gives the accused a chance, but simply because it reflects metaphysical truth. Fair trials are only fair trials because they are impartially dedicated to arriving at a conclusion based on the principles of the scientific method. Justice must never be about giving chances. Justice is the refusal of granting the unearned. An accused felon does not deserve a chance any more than the accuser deserves to have his claim taken seriously without evidence. Any time that the truth and the pursuit thereof is compromised for the sake of leniency, mercy, pity, or emotions, then one has removed all need for civilized society or objective law. One has then subscribed to the code of injustice. That does not mean, on the other hand, that there are never mitigating circumstances or cases where a mild penalty is in order. What it means is that in such cases, the main consideration must not be mercy or pity for the accused, but rather it must be logically argued that given all the circumstances of the case at hand, justice itself is better served through leniency. Consider what it would mean to sacrifice justice and what that would mean to the concept of law and to civilization. Justice is not an issue in a dictatorship, in a land where the word of the state is law. There's no practical advantage of having courts, since the rules of justice and of the scientific method can be ignored at the whim of any given man in power. Such a society would be no better off than in a state of anarchy, where justice has no practical enforcement, save for the application of brute force, the same brute force that can be applied unjustly. In fact, once justice has been disposed of, there is little use for organized society at all, since, at least in a state of anarchy, people have the option of defending themselves, whereas under a dictatorship, the general population is helplessly disarmed. People living under dictatorship have no recourse to law, principle, or justice. Physical force is their only option. If justice is to be compromised at whim, then the average citizen can have no expectations at all of other people, and then must fight or be destroyed. Notice that in the history of dictatorship, violence has been the way of life, and fear the only motivation. Dictatorships are marked with sudden bloody coups, most often put down through ruthless extermination. Every country in the world today is guilty of sacrificing justice to an irrational whim. However, the principles of justice remain largely upheld and recognized within what is sometimes called the Anglosphere. The country is broadly encompassed by the Anglo-Saxon culture, certainly the United States having historically been the best example, but also Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, to a great but sadly diminishing degree. In these countries, citizens have some recourse to law and can usually, but not always, expect rationality and the scientific method to be employed in their claims. Such recourse does not exist in places like Cuba, Iran, China, North Korea, and not even in Russia these days. Such societies are not subordinated to the rule of justice, but rather to the rule of the gun. Justice ends where a gun begins. Justice is an application of truth and reason. If truth and reason are to be discarded, then that leaves no other means of persuasion but of brute force. Honest people cannot be persuaded to obvious irrationality. They must be forced to act against their better judgment on pain of death, torture, or imprisonment. The flouting of justice in dictatorships takes on obvious forms, however, it occurs more subtly in more civilized countries. Justice cannot be cheated. Someone always pays, in one way or another. If someone guilty does not pay for his mistakes, then someone innocent does. Even less malicious mistakes are subject to the hard hand of justice. If someone accidentally breaks your window, either he makes amends or you suffer a loss at no fault of your own. It's that simple. That's why mercy and leniency are cruel to the innocent. The only one who should be allowed to extend mercy is the offended party himself, if he chooses to do so. Compassion, as such, is a very positive human trait, but it's important that it be applied carefully and not wasted on the guilty. Compassion can appropriately be extended to those who suffer for no fault of their own, but compassion for the guilty is treason to the innocent.
Spirit.
Once more, you're listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. My name is Paul Lambert. Responsibility is accepting the consequences of one's own choices. It's an acknowledgement of cause and effect and of one's application of justice. In a free society, freedom to choose is obviously the cornerstone of the ideals which are embodied in its institutions. However, simply saying that people are free to choose is not an axiom. Since man is a rational being, freedom of choice is a natural requirement of his mind. A man must be free to disagree with his fellow man and to act upon his own non-coerced, rational choice. To take away such a fundamental freedom would be to take away the very thing necessary for a man's survival qua man, his rational faculty. A human being can clearly sense when someone acts against his own sense of judgment and will normally not acquiesce unless he's self-destructive. The only argument that will make someone act against his own judgment is a gun, that is to say, physical force. Choice, of course, is an act of volition. It's the result of a certain judgment being made. It's a type of causation. Of course, a given choice will have a certain consequence. A cause will have an effect. Who must accept the consequences of these choices? A farmer who works in the field will perhaps choose to plant corn. The effect of this choice is that corn will come forth from the ground. Who shall be responsible for picking the corn? Should someone who has not chosen to plant the corn need to organize and supervise the picking for the benefit of the farmer? Moreover, who should have the right to the corn? Should it be some unknown stranger who took no part in the planting? Or should it be the farmer who chose to plant the corn in the first place? Accepting the consequences of one's own actions, be they good or bad, is the foundation of responsibility. Surely many people make bad choices and then suffer the consequences accordingly. Some choose not to work and consequently find themselves poor. Others drink excessive amounts of alcohol, overeat, gamble, or abuse cocaine. Such poor choices have their disastrous results. One can only hope that people will learn from their mistakes, however the consequences are theirs alone to bear. Other people might want to help them, but it's not something that can be demanded of them. There's a popular sentiment that people should be protected from themselves, and in demonstrable cases of madness or overtly destructive tendencies that harm other people, I'd agree. Otherwise, what that would amount to is a violation of individual freedom of choice. It's of no benefit for states to forbid certain actions that only hurt oneself. In fact, it's rather counterproductive. At worst, it ignores the principles of responsibility. Now, let me be clear. I do understand that there is real suffering in the world that results from choices being made by some individuals that results in harm to others. There are plenty of victims of crime, violence, racial and religious persecutions, planned famines, and centralized economy. It's only proper that one feel compassion for such people since they suffer unjustly due to someone else's irresponsibility or cruelty. Even in civilized countries, people are sometimes the victims of crime. It is proper to feel compassion for these people. However, most people's misfortune is a result of things they did to themselves or failed to do for themselves. It's a dreadful shame that entire social theories have been devised that center around the human misery brought about by the lack of judgment on the part of very few individuals, European social democratic welfare statism being one of them. To feel compassion for people who are simply unwilling to take responsibility for their own lives is moral treason to the very concept of justice and a cheap sellout of genuine compassion. If an individual must be held responsible for the action of others, then responsibility loses all sensible meaning. Why should anyone use prudent judgment, act cautiously, and be rational, when the reward for such is simply to be forced to pay for the mistakes of other people? After all, if instead one did not think before he acted, he could expect others to help him to escape the consequences of his poor choices. What reason, then, would anyone have to be responsible, to become a slave to the irresponsible? Of course, that question is lost on the welfare statist mentalities that rule Europe. They believe that as a matter of right, that some people should be held responsible for the choices made by others, choices that the ones who are held responsible had no power to make and never would have made. There are many people today who are blind, deaf, physically handicapped, mentally defective or otherwise impaired, who lead perfectly happy and productive lives and thrive in spite of their personal shortcomings. For able-bodied, healthy adults to walk the streets campaigning for their purported right to the product of other people's work, to the benefit of other people's imaginations, foresight, or ambition, is such an obvious and vulgar display of modern humanity's departure from justice, departure from responsibility, and departure from respect for his fellow man. Ignorance of the laws of man does not normally make for defense in the courts. Likewise, ignorance of the laws of nature will not defend someone against the harsh truth of reality. One disregards the rule of cause and effect at his own peril. The teenage mother, the drug addict, the alcoholic, the indigent, the obese, and the prison inmate have all ignored the rule of cause and effect and have all evaded their responsibility to themselves and have become a burden to others. Such people can certainly be redeemed, but it's a choice that each of them will have to make for himself. In actual fact, it's very seldom a case of ignorance, as most people realize that they are doing something wrong when they do it. In order to change their situations, they must first realize that it's their job to change it. This is the first step toward responsibility. Keeping this clearly in mind at all times, the rest will naturally follow. Thank you for tuning in tonight to VSI Radio International. Remember, the final episode in this series will air next week, Wednesday at 7 p.m. I hope you will tune in then as well. For now, this is Paul Lambert wishing you a pleasant week.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.